This is the Nobel Podcast, where we talk about how to optimize your technology, life, and mind. We're joined by special operations veterans, entrepreneurs, investors, and others who have overcome difficulty to make it to the top of their craft by staying in the fight. What's your name?
Kieran Carroll.
Where'd you grow up? I'll start with that one.
I was born in Washington, D.C. I grew up right outside of D.C. in Maryland, went to high school in Bethesda, and then from there went to the Naval Academy after high school.
So how old were you when you realized you wanted to go into the Naval Academy, do the military thing?
My dad was a Marine officer, like in the early 70s. We had been exposed to the military, I guess. And then the other thing too is I have a twin brother, and he also went to the Naval Academy, same class. He was way more forward-leaning with the military. But like realistically, after 9/11, I think that became the ultimate path. Obviously, the DC area was like heavily affected by 9/11, and we knew people that like lost their lives. Yeah. Our families knew people. So there was like obviously the element of, you know, retribution and doing something for your country. And then on top of that, my parents paid a shitload of money for private high school. So, you know, going somewhere on a military scholarship, either Service Academy or ROTC, made a lot of sense. I was heavily pushed to do that by my parents.
Where were you when 9/11 happened?
I was a junior in high school. I was at high school. I'll never forget this. I was like sitting in like first period class, and like somebody came in. They're like, a plane just hit the World Trade Center. And, you know, we didn't have like TVs in the classrooms like they do now, right? So like literally someone wheeled one of those like wheelie TV carts with like the old school fat boy TVs. We were watching when the second plane hit.
Did you get what that meant in junior year high school?
I think people knew that it was like going to be game on at that point.
Was that before or after you realized you wanted to go to Naval Academy?
It was like right about the time I was trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So like it definitely pushed me in that direction without a doubt.
So Naval Academy, did you know what you wanted to do? Pilot, SWO?
When I first went in, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I thought flying would have been cool. I really quickly ruled that out.
Was there an aspect that you were doing it? Like did you get to go on flights and stuff?
Yeah. So I actually got to fly in the back of an F-14. The pilot was such a dickhead. It was hilarious.
Well, that's the thing. They're supposed to be.
And like, I threw up, right, dude. Yeah, right. I blacked out. It was, and that was a piece of it. I was recruited to swim. So I went to swim. I started failing classes pretty much immediately freshman year. So I stopped swimming and I focused on academics. I eventually got my academics back up, but like, and I never fully recovered. I basically got forced into service warfare, which was okay. That happens to a lot of people. It's just a part of life there. The other option was Marine Corps ground. And like every person I talked to who wanted to be a Marine, I thought was like insufferable. So, you know,
what did your brother end up doing?
Right. So my brother, I think, would have been the number two SEAL selectee from our class. Collins, he's a freak athlete, super smart. He was an aerospace engineer. I was a history major, just to like differentiate us a little bit. He ended up getting kidney stones from lightweight crew. They didn't give him SEALs. And I think he always had a chip on his shoulder based on that. So he ended up eventually going Marine ground, force recon, and then did other stuff after that. But yeah, he's always been super butthurt about that.
But so, a less insufferable Marine, or?
Oh, no, equally? he was equally as insufferable. Honestly, a lot of the NSW guys were also insufferable.
This is the part of your story I don't know, so I'm super stoked to get it filled in.
Let's do it.
You became SWO, and then somehow you went extremely non-traditional and unconventional. What, just go over that.
Yeah, so I was a terrible SWO. I did my first tour on an amphib out of Little Creek in Virginia Beach. Spent 2 years on the ship. It was one of those things where like they didn't have a job for you, right? There were so many junior officers on board. Obviously, Carter Stapleton from our team was also on the Ashland. I basically just went to a series of schools, right? For the first 3, 4, 5 months I was on board. The fleet has like the boarding teams. I went and did, you know, those schools. I did some other stuff. And then we deployed. So we were like the afloat forward staging base between the two oil platforms, like literally right off the beach in Iraq. The op line between Iraq and Iran is also right there. So there's like the Iranian stuff going on. We had like Brits on board. We had Iraqi Navy Marine guys on board. For my first experience working with like partner forces was that. Was really weird. We also did like the anti-piracy stuff off Somalia and East Africa. So we were the Southeast Africa Partnership Station as well.
What were you guys doing? Patrolling?
Yeah, we were just out there. So the Marines that were supposed to be on the amphib ended up flying off to Afghanistan right before we deployed. Mm. So we went out there basically with no actual mission set beyond, hey, establish presence, do some VBSS stuff. It's basically advise and assist off Iraq as well as sort of like the naval version of that. We also hit like 11 ports on that deployment. So we were frequently in port. We did exercises with like the Israelis. We were in Israel for 2 weeks over Easter Sunday. I ended up going underway with an Israeli warship. So that was also sort of a first introduction into like working with partner forces. I did my, 2 years during that time. The Navy stood up this thing called the Riverine Forces. The Riverine Forces were like something totally different, right? And like all beautiful creatures, the Navy ended up killing it because it was too pure for this world. But
the Riverine is a beautiful creature too pure for this world.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I like to think of it, right? So in 06, when OIF had been going full swing for a few years, the SBTs in particular, like Special Boat Team 22, NSW made the decision to pull SBT 22 out of Iraq, which left a gap. So the Navy was like, all right, we're going to go build basically SWIC Light. So they pulled together a bunch of like, it was like the Island of Misfit Toys, right? We had guys that had come from Damnak. We had guys that were SWIC. The officers, the O's involved were a mixture of EOD officers and surface warfare officers. They gave us a lot of training, everything from like ground warfare stuff all the way through the boat stuff. And then they upskilled a lot of people too into like JTAC, into, human collection. And all the training was down at Camp Lejeune. Once you got selected to go, you went through 6 months of schools, roughly, maybe a little bit more. Then you got to your unit and you did a workup to go to Iraq. So by the time I showed up to Riverine Squadron 2, these guys had just gotten back from OIF. It had been kinetic for them. They had a good deployment from that perspective.
What was the Riverine doing in Iraq that was kinetic?
So they did everything from like direct action. They did obviously insert, extract. What was interesting about the Riverine units too is that the boat debts had their own ground debt as part of it. So it was like, again, this hodgepodge thing of like, you get four boats and then you have like 10 or 12 dudes that would hop out on the ground and go do limited operations ashore.
For a SWO daddy, crack deal.
It was absolutely a crack deal. And I think the more interesting thing is like, if you look at the SWO, the junior officers who were SWOs there and like where they ended up going into more interesting places, I think that was like the breeding ground for a lot of it.
It sounds like it was entrepreneurial. Like it sounds like it was an early stage startup too early stage and dynamic to survive.
Right. So black and white from the fleet, right? So the fleet, everything's like checklist, right? Yeah. You gotta fucking do this and check the boxes, right? It gets Riverine, there was none of that. We took like IADs from NSW, we took stuff from the Marine Corps, yeah. We smashed it together. And then of course you have the EOD guys that have their own sort of like their spin on things. And it was an incredible organization to be part of. There were three squadrons at the time. And then 2010 happened and then they did the reduction in force. So our detachment never ended up going. So it was a major letdown. And then for a year and a half, it was like, well, like now what the fuck do we do? Right. And this is where I really started, they sent me to a bunch of schools, right? I went to a bunch of human schools on SOCOM dollars.
So we're using acronyms for almost everything. Let's define some.
It's human intelligence collection as a collector.
So as a surface warfare officer, you were learning, spy.
Yeah. Right? Sources, methods, right. all that fun. The stuff that sounds cool.
How many other surface warfare officers get to do that?
I mean, there's a handful. There's a handful.
So you did a deployment that was, relatively speaking, like a pretty cool SWO deployment.
Yeah.
And then you got to do a Riverine, which was like, seems pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Then it basically they, down selected in 2010, 3 years into your career, whatnot.
Basically, they were looking for guys to go to Afghanistan on a special sort of special projects type of thing. So I ended up doing that. I was in Afghanistan, I think, for 13 months between July of 2011 through like August of 2012. And I went over there as a collector, specifically focused on like document media exploitation collection on the battlefield. So think of like ripping people's cell phones, like tactically.
So
like,
you're with the ground unit. You're on site and then you take your collection.
But so this was the best deployment I've ever had, I think. And it's really hard to top it because I went over there, I was chopped over to CJ Soda through a program called TACDOMEX, which, was basically a standalone Afghanistan unit. It's hard to describe what it was. But I showed up and they're like, hey, you're going to go to Sangin to start. So I went to Sangin, height of the fighting season, July of 2011, I literally just hung out with infantry Marines for like 6 months, and some ODAs and some other guys that were like in the AO 1st Battalion, 5th Marines was there. They got really gnarly for them, super kinetic. And then 3-7 chopped or ripped out with them. And then 3-7 ended up, you know, getting torn up a little bit. I had no oversight, like literally no oversight for months. I could do whatever the fuck I wanted to do. I could jump out.
Crack deal.
I could go out on clearing ops or raids or snap VCPs or vehicle checkpoints, right? Or whatever. I'd go assist with
and, like... And all your training and stuff was still like, you know, interrogations, you know, following people and whatever. And now you're doing...
Yeah, I did some of that too. So it turns out the Marines have really robust human stuff already. So right. It's not like... I didn't really add a ton of value. They had like these human exploitation teams. I would sit in there with them. I would try to help them out, like low-level source operations. All the soft teams to the north of us, so there's like their ODA teams, MSOTs, they typically had their own human capability, right? So like it was less of that and it was more of like, hey, like, do you guys need an extra gun? Like,
so who's going to carry that's my gel? Question. Yeah. So you go, you know, you were a swimmer. You go to the Naval Academy, you go to surface warfare, you know, on ships, Riverine, where you kind of get to do a lot cooler stuff. But like you haven't gone through like a bunch, like blocks of kind of basic infantry training or whatever it is at this point, or have you?
Oh, no, that was heavily
Riverine. So you got to do some of that stuff.
Yeah.
So you get to go be a shooter
out
of the SWO community, which is
unusual.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're on this deployment. Did you ever feel overwhelmed by this?
The Riverine Schoolhouse is basically the school of infantry to start. Okay. So like, yeah, I mean, what I'm getting weird is that I was a full lieutenant at 03 and like, I'd be out with like a squad of Marines, dude. And they're like looking at me like maneuver stuff. I'm like, hey man, like I'm literally just here as a strap hanger. Like, but you know,
just here for the fun, man.
I would recommend that we don't walk through the IEDs, right? Like, you know, stuff like that. The overwhelming piece to me was watching really bad tactics happen, like in daylight, in the green zone, in IED belts, and like, you know, not a shot at the Marine Corps, but I think that they made some missteps quite frequently when I was out there. But I would never say that to them while I was out there, you know.
So you got this cool autonomous deployment with the Marines.
Yeah.
So what happened next, and how did that come
about? So I was in Sangin, and then I got a call one day, and they're like, hey, can you go cover for this guy who was down in Marja? Marja had been like super gnarly earlier in the war, like a year or two before that. I show up and they're like, can you go down and like hang out with 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines? I was like, you gotta be shitting me. Cause like, that's my brother's at that unit. So my brother took a hot fill billet to be their S2, their intel officer, after he left recon. So I called my brother like on the, you know, the Sipper VoIP phone or whatever. I was like, hey, I'm coming down to hang out. He's like, dude, no, you're not. I'm like, all right. So then like 3 days later, like the bird drops me off in the LZ and I have all my shit. I'm like, hey, like, can someone get Captain Carroll out here to help me like carry this stuff? So Colin comes down. He's like, God damn it. But it was more of the same. Like, you know, I again had very little oversight. I had a civilian like FSR I was working with at the time who was like, honestly did most of like the actual like exploitation work, which just freed me up to go do whatever I wanted to do. So I bounced out again, you know, all the time, you know, basically to hang out. I went on some stuff with my brother, which probably shouldn't have happened. The battalion commander like figured it out a few weeks in that we were related, which was funny. And he was like, you can't ever tell anybody this. The Sullivan brothers rule from the AV and all, whatever. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but it was cool. I guess see my brother kind of operate in his element. And then they called me and they're like, hey, can you come back to Kabul at the time? So SIFSOC was like the 1-star white soft headquarters in Afghanistan. And then CJ Sotov was like the 06 level, like tactical kind of command, right? That had a bunch of VSP sites and VSO sites. So I show up in Bagram to what I thought was this going to be like a headquarters element job, but they kicked me over to this actually a really interesting program, special program that was looking at the time they called green on blue threats, right? So like, you know, you had bad actors that had infiltrated the Afghan National Army or the Afghan local police or whatever. Turns out they're all bad actors, right? For the most part. Can we like collect on these guys, right? To predict or figure out, or, you know, for targeting purposes, like what can we do?
So green on blue, the threat was that the Afghan partner forces might kill American forces.
They'd already been doing it. So they're trying to get ahead of it. We had a cover team through the Ministry of Interior called the in-processing team. So when you guys are out at VSPs, right, or VSOs, and you had these Afghan local police partner force guys, the Afghan Minister of Interior was responsible for like paying them, training them, equipping them, all this stuff. And as you guys are intimately familiar, most of these dudes either were or were former Taliban at the time that we just paid to switch sides. Turns out it doesn't work out that way. We had these in-processing teams, and CIFSOC had, I think, four or five elements that would go out as part of the, using the in-processing team as a cover to go like exploit phones and like, you know, do some like source operations. So there were a bunch of like SEAL 03s, Army SF, E8, who was like one of the guys. I got hooked up with these dudes. That's what I did for the next 6 months. I flew around all over Afghanistan. I probably went to at least 50 VSO sites, maybe more than that. We always had like these Afghan dudes in tow with us who were Ministry of Interior guys that we could just use to like get into these places. We go out to VSOs for a few days at a time and just collect a lot of intel on and targeting stuff on who was good, who was bad. We obviously sent it all back up to actual intel analysts and stuff like that to go action. But that was my first like introduction to like big soft, right? Like being this headquarters element. This is also where I first started meeting a bunch of dudes I would later go work for.
This was all in that first 13-month deployment.
Yeah, yeah. So I rolled out August of 2013. I was in a helicopter hard landing towards the end of my time there. Honestly, I was like the least injured guy. But like people broke bones and badly lacerated their heads. It was out in Anghar, actually.
What kind of helicopter?
It was a 60 from Florida Guard, I believe. And it was a brownout. It was like 4:30 in the morning. These guys hit like a wire that was kind of along the ground a little bit. And the back end of the bird slammed down. And the pilots didn't want to fly it out. They trucked a wrecker out from JBAD.
Was this on a target or is this just...
We were going out for a KLE. So there was like an OD-18 that... Key leader engagement. There was an OD-18 that had like secured the LZ sort of, but it was also dark and it was at night. So it was really hard to do it. Rocky. They called a medevac bird in. One dude had broken collarbones. So he was probably the worst guy. The pilots... They medevac them out. So it was, ended up holding security around this bird for a couple of days. Well, it was supposed to be like a 4-hour rob, ended up being like a 2-day fucking marathon of, getting this truck out.
How scared were you? And did you realize how bad everybody was? You said you were the least injured guy, but with that kind of stuff in helicopters, I've been in a lot of close calls.
Yeah.
The worst part for me is I was usually on the comms because I was a JTAC and I had the responsibilities.
Yeah.
And I've been in helicopters where I heard pilots go, fuck, 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 fuck.
So
and like, that is literally just like, oh, we're dying.
The crew chief,
right,
as we were landing, we were probably like 7-8 feet off the ground. It wasn't
that. So it's just hard.
It was a super hard landing.
Right.
I was the only guy wearing a helmet and I had like a dork. I had my helo lanyard on, right? Other guys didn't do that.
So I've become afraid of helicopters probably by that point. I've seen a lot of stuff. I would immediately put my helo lanyard on.
Dude,
yeah. I'd get in. And the 30 seconds thing, no, man, like I'd have it like ready to unhook. I'd get it cleared. I was like a 5-second helo dude. Like I'm not falling out of this thing at 300 feet.
Nope.
No way.
Nope.
I've been in enough helicopters to know that if I'm unhooked 30 seconds before landing, they make a lot of crazy moves that I could fall out.
Yeah. And my wife, we were in Hawaii or something. She's like, oh, we should do this helicopter tour. I was like, nope. I was like, done with this forever.
I'm good. Yeah.
It's an amazing deployment for a surface warfare officer.
Had a very good deployment.
You made a bunch of crucial introductions.
Yeah.
How did that pivot into your next role?
So I had orders down to the Defense Intelligence Agency down in Charlottesville. It's kind of a crack deal, but like, I believe they were actually coded for a surface warfare officer. I could be wrong about that, but like they tried to slide me in based on the human stuff, right? Then big Navy found out that I was in a hard landing and that I had a separated disc in my back. And someone freaked out in the chain of command. They're like, what is this guy even doing here? Right? Kind of thing.
From the surface warfare community from DIA?
From Millington. So Millington, Bupers, right?
The overarching orders of the Navy.
The surface warfare community managers. And they're like, we need to get him back to a military treatment facility to get, physical therapy and whatever. And honestly, I was like, fine. I mean, for the most part, I was fine. So they sent me back to Walter Reed in Bethesda. It used to be called Bethesda Naval. Now it's Walter Reed. I was there for about a year and I didn't really have a job. Like they gave me like some bullshit program management job, which I didn't hardly ever showed up for. Again, like, I didn't have a ton of oversight. There are other people that like in the office I worked in, it was like the non-medical wounded warrior, Navy's wounded warrior office kind of a thing. We did not have a ton of wounded warriors in the Navy. And the ones that we did typically came out of soft. So SOCOM had the CARE Coalition guys and that's where they all went to. So
I want to go over this in my head. the time in the Navy where Kieran Carroll didn't really have a job. Let's start your first ship. You just basically learn and you don't really do anything. So that's not really a job.
Right.
Your second one was like a commissioning, kind of a new thing and kind of doing that. And it's a job, but like the responsibilities, whatever, are nebulous.
I mean, you're a mission commander. Like,
So that one's a job.
That's a job.
And then basically for that 13-month deployment, it was whatever you wanted to do. You were basically entrepreneurial soldier who was just like, this seems like a fun fight.
Right.
And then after that, you had a hard landing and then you're supposedly recovering without a job.
Yeah. I mean, I'd go to physical therapy and
whatever. You had literally years where there's like very little to no supervision.
Yeah. This is one of them. I lived in DC with like my high school friends. Like it was whatever. Right. An Army 06 that I met, he had this incredible background. I met him in Afghanistan. He was either at CIFSOC or he was like one of the supporting things. He was like a special mission unit guy, intel dude, signature. He randomly hit me up one day and was like, hey, like, you know, I enjoyed working with you. I would drive him around and stuff sometimes. Enjoyed working with you. Like, what are you up to now? I was like, hey, I'm over here at Walter Reed. I'm at that time, I was thinking about getting out. I'm like, right. I like bought my GMAT test prep book, you know? And he's like, hey, like, you know, have you thought about, and he was one of the lead JSOC liaisons to the NSA at the time. And he's like, have you thought about maybe coming over here? And he's like, I could try to find something interesting for you to do.
The JSOC or NSA?
He was a JSOCer at NSA.
Okay.
So like, there's a bunch of them. Like they sit there, you know, whatever, and coordinate and, you know, target. And I was like, yeah, it sounds cool. I was like, the Navy will never let me do this. And he was like, well, let me make some calls. You know, who do I have to talk to? So I gave him like my detail, like my career manager's name. Luckily, at the time, my career manager had come from Riverine Squadron and he was an 08 Naval Academy grad. And this dude's a future admiral. Like, guy's awesome. And he was like, fuck it. Like, yeah, like let him go. So they cut me orders, 3-year orders. At this point, I was so off course for typical SWO promotions or milestones is what they call
it. Sure, they weren't a SWO.
Right. And like, I didn't care because like, I didn't plan on making the Navy a career, right? I just wanted to keep doing interesting stuff. So I owe this one dude in particular a bunch of beers for actually getting the orders to go over there. So I went to the National Security Agency for like roughly 3 years. And when I first showed up, I don't have a SIGINT background. Like obviously don't have a cyber background. They made me go through information warfare officer school to start. So that's down like Pensacola.
Which like, 22 year olds go to that, right?
Yeah.
That's like the first school if you're in that group.
Yeah, exactly. If you're an information warfare officer in the Navy, you start there. And it's like 8 weeks in Pensacola. Information warfare community, though, has a lot of like, they call them accessions. So like they have a lot of 03s, 04s coming from other career specialties into the community.
There's a bunch of dudes at that school is like, who is that guy? Don't worry about it.
I think a lot of people with interesting backgrounds. Yeah. And then you have a lot of like prior enlisted guys. And then I show up and the XO, you know, not a lot of people probably realize this or understand this, but the National Security Agency, right, is a Department of Defense agency, right? So you have a bunch of civilians that work there that keep the lights going that are like the sort of the key decision makers. But then you have like a ton of military people that are like revolving it out of there. And the Navy, I think, has something like, at the time when I was there, I think with the Navy had like almost 2,000 people at actual Fort Meade, like NSA headquarters. But you never know it. I showed up and the one requirement the Navy made me do besides the school was I had to go qualify on the battle watch floor that the Navy has there. And I think I set like the all-time record to qualify and get the fuck off the battle watch floor because it was brutal.
What is the battle watch floor?
It is a operations center that you sit there in 12-hour shifts and, you know, you have a bunch of analysts doing their stuff, right? A lot of it was tracking like foreign naval assets and whatever else, right? You're also
a room that's an operations center, a bunch of people staring at computers, big TVs around the wall, maps of the world.
Yeah.
Television screens.
Yeah, basically.
You have to run a operations center.
You got to sit for like murder boards and stuff and whatever else.
What's a murder board?
A murder board is when they ask you a lot of questions rapidly and make you feel really dumb. If you're in the fleet and you're an officer, you sit through a lot of murder boards in your career, either getting murder boarded or murder boarding somebody else. Anyway, so I had to do that. I think I was there for maybe like 2 months tops. You know, you weren't there every day. It was like, I think you had like three or four day shifts or whatever. When I left, I went to NSA's counterterrorism directorate. I was one of the JSOC liaisons. There's a bunch of them. And I had East Africa and the Arabian Peninsula were the two AOs I focused in.
what on a high level was it that you were doing in the Arabian Peninsula? What was the overarching objective? And
so I supported like all the tier one units that were operating out of there.
Okay.
So national level collection, right? So like you think of like, you know, the various assets that we have flying, collecting, or, you know, waterborne assets or whatever, all the way down to like the tactical, like guys putting devices in places who support specific operations.
So it sounds ambiguous. Did you have a direct order, or were you again making up your own way as you went along?
I mean, the direct order came all the way down from the National Security Council, and it was, how do you target, kill, or capture like these bad dudes, right? So it's like the JPEL targeting list, but for those AOs.
What's a JPEL targeting list?
It's like the Joint Prioritized Effects List. So it's like, you know, it's the bad people that we're interested in affecting.
So you had a list of bad people you needed to affect.
Right.
And your task was to go out there and affect it and figure it out.
And the NSA analysts, right, the intel guys and the collectors, they're the ones who are out there that are collecting on the network, mapping the network, analyzing the network, figuring out what the next step is and how do we get closer to this person and how do we get in this person's comms. But at the end of the day, like, these are the guys that in the movies, when you see people like he's moving from here to there and like we have on ISR and we have his like his cell phone selector and they cross correlate all this stuff. These are the guys that are doing that.
And you were part of that.
Yes, the NSA guys were doing it, but I was one taking that and feeding it back over into the JSOC world. And I also worked a bunch with the CIA and some of the other interagency stuff. I worked with like the JSOC, like, you know, Delta, right? Had some stuff going on. DANMAC, Naval Special Warfare and Development Group, owned both of those AOs from the tactical perspective, right? Like they were the forward forces that were there. So I got to know DevGru really well from that perspective. And then obviously the agency has their stuff going on. Then there's a bunch of other JSOC units that, you know, may or may not be very well known that are also over there doing their specific thing. But anyway, while I was in the NSA, I ended up going back to Afghanistan twice, actually.
You were supposed to be on a watch floor in a room feeding information to people.
Yeah, not even really a watch floor, right? Like it's really hard to describe unless you're there, but like you're there, you're a conduit, right? You're a conduit because like you got...
So they collect their information.
Right.
Where's the bad guy? They're in this car. These are the ways we're going to find out. Right. And you're like...
I spent a lot of time watching ISR feeds, right? Like,
so you give this information to the dudes on the ground, whatever they be, super sneaky, you know, tip of the spear kind of dudes.
Right.
And then you're like, you know what? I should go over there.
Yeah. And while I was there, I had a really good senior executive that I worked with. And again, being sort of weird, right? There were several times where they would bring me into these National Security Council meetings and I would literally just sit in the back like this and not say anything against a wall with like 30 other people that were there for the same reason. And they would either call them PCs, which are principal committees. So you think of like the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense are all in these meetings, or they're like one or two levels below that. So like they're their deputies. When I was in there, they were like, okay, like, we were getting target packages approved essentially, right? So you got to sit up there and defend and be like, here's what we have on this guy or whoever, right? And then, you know, everyone with equities, as they used to like to say, would sit there and be like, you know, I don't know, right? Or, you know, the Department of the Treasury guy would be like, well, you know, if we remove him, then we lose this intel line of, you know, threat finance stuff, right?
How did you go from where you are right now in the story to transitioning out of the military?
Yeah. So I left in December 2015. I went to SEAL Team 18 as a reservist. I went to the SEAL Team 18 as a special boat unit. And while I was there, the DANMAC guys were like, hey, do you want to come back to active duty for a little bit? I said, yeah. So I ended up going back for like 18 months, deployed, you know, depending on how you look at it, either two or three more times to North Africa. Was the OIC of a JSOC maneuver unit that was a boat. Probably like professionally one of the most rewarding things I've done, I think. By that time, my wife was so pissed, right, with all this stuff. I went back into the reserves after that, back to 18 for a little bit. And then...
What year is this?
I got done like early 2018, you know, like mid 2018.
Okay. So we found Azira's early mid 2018. So you're getting out early.
Yeah. I was getting out, went back to the reserves. I went to PwC as a consultant for my full-time thing.
How did you go from the reserves to PwC?
So, I came here to Philly. I didn't have a job. So like, I literally ran to Sean Toole and I think at like a bar or something. And he was like, I can get you a job within 2 weeks. And I was like, that sounds awesome.
You got out without a plan or an idea.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I started talking to people, but like, you know, I didn't have And then, you know, consulting is just like kind of a catch-all, right? So I, you know, did consulting for 15 months or whatever it was, 16 months.
Naval Academy, Surface Warfare Officer, Riverine, deployed with Marines, did whatever you wanted in country, got super sneaky organizations, back home, NSA, then further sneaky, reserves, Danneck, PWC.
Yeah.
And then startup, and then we met.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think in there too, when I was at PWC, I started my executive MBA and then wrapped that up while I was here.
What did you think about Zero Eyes before you joined it and you were aware of it?
I mean, I think when Rob and Mike told me the whole thing, I was like, this is a game changer. If this can work, this is a game changer.
What was the discussion like to drop your job with PWC to join
it? So we met at Bunker Labs, I think was the first time, right? And so if you were doing your pitch of your company, like you certainly did in that thing, and maybe we were together, but I think you were supposed to be like someone who helped out.
Yeah.
And we were doing a bunch of pitch decks, and like we had gone, you know, to business school, whatever. Like we were okay at PowerPoint, like having gone to business school, but like we were enlisted dudes. So like typically the officers from the Naval Academy do a lot more PowerPoint decks than we do. And he was a consultant. Consultants basically are PowerPoint wizards. And you're like, I can help you for free. And free was a great price for us.
It's the only price for you.
Right. It was the only price at the time because like we had no money. We were doing the WeWork thing, and then he'd help out. And so like we met in, you know, a WeWork in Philly where he would help us with like the silly thing is just like, is that the right color periwinkle blue?
Is this kind of like when you join the Riverines or that Afghan deployment with the Marines, or you basically just figure it the fuck out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what we've all had to do this entire time, right? Like, there's no playbook we're executing from. Like, this doesn't exist.
I feel like your role, like even right now today, is still similar to that. So talk about what you're doing with strategy and how it's this vague overarching agenda and how you're maneuvering through it. Let's just leave it broad like that.
For one thing, I think it's unusual for like post Series A and Series B companies to even have like a strategy team, because that conjures up more of like a corporate development arm, which hopefully we grow into that one day, right? That would be awesome. But I think right now it's all about how do you accelerate rapid growth? That's, you know, what we're focused on. So we have the government affairs effort, which so far seems to be going really well. The end goal for the company, right, is that our software capability is basically part of everyday life for a camera. Like it's a standardized feature across all security cameras for the most part. Realistically, right, there's no political solution to gun violence in our lifetime, so we have to do something technology wise to be a stopgap, and we're a good layer to that. So it's going and, you know, talking to policymakers and educating them about this kind of stuff. We're so new and unique and differentiated that we get a lot of attention on us. Plus our backgrounds, right? We hire veterans, we bring veterans into emerging technology roles, plays really well with policymakers. And then it's like the other thing that we're focused on too, right, is a competitive roadmap. Like, how do we stay competitive as a company? So we look at like FedRAMP, we look at Safety Act, we look at ISO and SOC 2, and these things that we have to do as a company to be competitive in the market. And they're major muscle movement for the company. They impact every single team. And so the strategy team kind of helps coordinate a lot of that stuff, because there's so many balls in the air as we're trying to get FedRAMP done, for example. And then it's like, well, what's after FedRAMP? And so we're looking at all that kind of stuff too. And then there's like the random strategic initiatives or special projects or whatever you want to call them. So like the insurance stuff for us, right, which could be huge down the road, but you got to start somewhere at some point, and we're starting now. We're probably a little bit ahead of our skis on it, but can our software impact the insurance market and bring the insurance market into our market? And I think so far the answer seems like, yeah, maybe. And that would be huge.
You said, you know, maybe we're a little ahead of our skis. So going to business school, knowing the story that you just told is like, I know that you've downplayed this, but it's the most interesting SWO in the Navy kind of stuff. I am aware that there's like,
turns out I'm not actually
two or three others or whatever it is, but that is an outrageous make-believe.
It doesn't even sound real.
It sounds phony.
Yeah.
you've never had stability in your professional career, even going to school, I would argue, based on what you said, where you were like on a trajectory where you started and you finished in a different direction. So right. In stages of companies, particularly in entrepreneurship, you'll see that maybe some people are better, you know, at different stages. I still don't know what stage we are best at. You know, we're trying to go our way through, yeah. But like, I worked at Amazon in a very late stage thing,
correct?
Not the best fit for me personally.
Yeah.
And I thrive in chaos. And to say that you don't, that you only know chaos, do you see yourself in a different thing? How do you view yourself for other people who, I mean, I don't know that anybody's going to get as interesting of a career, but like, how do you see that playing in your life?
I think it's true of all of us, not just me, right? But I think anyone that like went through some of the stuff that we did throughout the global war on terror and all these different things, I think we bring organization to chaos. Like that's one of our biggest strengths. And we have a lot of people that with that strength on our team, without a doubt. If you're not operating in that environment, like you have to be able to organize chaos.
Sounds like you've had a lot of job interviews or connected the dots through driving people in, you know, G-Wagons overseas to meetings behind closed doors where you're the silent dude in the back.
Yeah.
To connecting dots in like a chaos world, you were able to have these individual connections that kind of advance you that you didn't plan or see coming. So very entrepreneurial. You joined us. Was that because you were running towards something or running away from something?
Obviously, was excited about what you guys were doing. Right. Waking up every morning and seeing a mass shooting in the newspaper, you know, and then knowing that there's a potential layered solution out there for it. Hard to live with myself otherwise, right? If I couldn't come here and work on it. I wake up every morning excited to get to work. Like, it sounds stupid to say that, but it's literally true. You know what I mean? And like, we don't have the corporate environment here, which is awesome.
Doing everything we can not to have it.
Right. We should never have that. If at all, we can help that. We all operate at a high level and we resonate at that level. I think we've done a good job attracting people that resonate at that frequency into the company.
That's it for this episode. If you want to check out more from the podcast, head to zeroeyes.com/Nobel, where you can see show notes, read more about our guests, and suggest guests or topics of your own. Until next time, stay in the fight. Don't ring the bell.